From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Boy George, the 80s pop star who wore more makeup than Elizabeth Taylor, has a new CD and a new autobiography that reveal what he assumes you already figured out. He's gay. Also, we meet the co-creator of the most popular TV series in the world, Baywatch. Around the globe, people tune in to see hunks and trunks and babes in bathing suits as they patrol the beach, saving people from drowning and learning lessons about meaningful relationships. We'll meet the guitarist of Los Straitjackets, a new band that plays 90s surf music. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Mrs. Ted Bliss, the final book by the late Stanley Elkin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Bosnian Prime Minister says his country has withdrawn a boycott threat and will attend a Bosnian peace talk tomorrow in New York. Premier Haris Alijic spoke with two U.S. peace negotiators today who were working quickly to save the discussions. The talks are to work out disagreement over constitutional arrangements for a post-war Bosnia. The Bosnian government had threatened to boycott tomorrow's talks because it wants the Bosnian Serbs to promise that the Serbs will not secede from a new Bosnia. Federal investigators have delayed a flight test that was supposed to determine the possible cause of last year's U.S. air crash outside of Pittsburgh. Mike Benson is a spokesman for the National Transportation Safety Board. He says the tests will resume tomorrow.
We postponed the test today until tomorrow. The start of them will be tomorrow because of a mechanical problem with one of the aircraft. We expect that'll be finished, be completed in the terms of the work needed to be done, and the test will start tomorrow and run for the rest of the week and into the following week.
The crash last year killed 132 people. The 50th session of the United Nations General Assembly opens in New York today. More than 100 foreign ministers will debate tough questions about the future of the world body. The UN is facing one of its worst financial crises in history. The UN finished its regular budget in mid-August and is now borrowing from the Peacekeeping Fund. That is also in debt. The United States owes the most money to the UN, more than $1.5 billion, but the United States is demanding that the UN cut back financially. The jury in the New York terror trial resumes deliberations on Wednesday after a break for Rosh Hashanah. They started deliberating on Saturday, but it's expected to take a couple of weeks to reach a verdict. Carrie Nolan of member station WNYC reports.
The allegations in the biggest terrorism trial in U.S. history are spectacular. Omar Abdelrahman, a blind Egyptian cleric, is charged with leading Muslim followers in a plot to bomb the United Nations, the FBI's Manhattan offices, the Holland and Lincoln tunnels, and the George Washington Bridge, all in a single day. He also is accused of inspiring others to kill Rabbi Meir Kahane in 1990 and planned to assassinate Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. After 9 months of testimony, the jury received the case on Saturday, following 200 pages of instructions from the judge. They deliberated for 90 minutes before recessing for the day. On Sunday, deliberations began just before noon. Sources say returning a verdict could take some time, given the amount of evidence and testimony. For National Public Radio, I'm Carrie Nolan in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 3.5 points at 4,760 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq has fallen more than 9 points to 1,044. This is NPR. Baltimore Gas and Electric Company is going to acquire Potomac Electric Power Company in a deal worth more than $3 billion in stock. The agreement would create one of the nation's largest power companies with more than 2 million customers in Maryland and Washington, D.C. The merger is the latest in a consolidation effort within the power industry that has seen utility firms join up to cut costs and become more competitive in bidding for energy and consumers. These two firms plan to cut about 10% of their workforce over 10 years. They estimate they will save more than $1 billion. Colorado officials say the cleanup of debris scattered by the state's summer snowstorm might not be finished until November. They also say storm-related repairs may take up to 2 years. UPI's Dick Kelsey reports from Denver.
Denver Public Works Director Julius Jaco said a dozen city drop-off points for tree limbs are filling up fast. He estimated that debris turned in yesterday alone could fill at least the playing field of Mile High Stadium. Crews restored power to the last 150 customers out of 100,000 who lost electricity when thousands of limbs broke under the weight of heavy snow and downed power lines. Officials said power should be restored to everybody by the end of the day, and retailers say homeowners who need a chainsaw will have to wait a few days because they're sold out. Dick Kelsey, Denver.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees is holding meetings in Geneva to try to resolve the fate of 1 million Rwandan refugees. The refugees are camping in Zaire, but the Zairean government is threatening to throw them out by the end of the year unless they leave. The commissioner is meeting with ministers from Rwanda and Zaire, hoping to ease the movement of refugees back home. Many of them are afraid they'll be killed when they return to Rwanda, even though the Rwandan government is promising them safety. Most of the refugees are Hutus, who fled the country after last year's civil war. Hutus murdered more than 1 million Tutsis in the war. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The British singer Boy George was a pop star in the 80s. With his band Culture Club, he had such hits as Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, Karma Chameleon, and I'll Tumble For You. His music was somewhere between pop, soul, and reggae. His look was somewhere between male and female. Culture Club fell apart in 1986, and so did Boy George, who was trying to kick a heroin habit. He cleaned up, but didn't reestablish himself in the States until the film The Crying Game. His version of the title song ran under the closed credits. Now Boy George has a new autobiography called Take It Like a Man. He also has a new CD called Cheapness and Beauty, in which he sings lyrics from an unambiguously gay point of view. This is called Same Thing in Reverse. George, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello.
Now, how does it feel to sing songs now that acknowledge that you're gay?
Well, I guess all my songs have, in a way, been sort of gay love songs, in a sense. In the past, they were kind of ambiguous.
I'm trying to think, you know, in your lyrics in the past, was it always like a you instead of a she or a she or a he that you were addressing?
I think it was general, you know, we kept it ambiguous. The first time I ever recorded with Culture Club, the first demos we ever made were for EMI Records. Mm-hmm. And a song called Eyes of Medusa was one of our first songs. And in that, I sang He Loves Me, He Hates Me. And there was a whole incident where the engineer stopped me and said, you're saying he. And then the whole band had a big discussion about it. And we decided that it would be better to not alienate people. So in a way, what I've done is gone back to my original way of writing and just written from the heart, really.
Now, let me explain. I'm in a studio in Philadelphia. You're in a studio in New York. We're connected by wires, so I'm not seeing you. What's your look now?
It's kind of Priscilla Presley meets Alice Cooper.
Why don't you describe what you're wearing, how your hair is?
Well, my hair's kind of like 60s with a bit of punk. It's kind of like beehive-y. And I have on fierce black eyeliner that kind of sweeps up towards the sky. And then I have kind of quite normal clothes. It's kind of casual with a twist. I have these kind of weird pants, which I bought in Japan. Kind of bright blue Versace boots, an orange check shirt, and a kind of grey jacket from Jean Paul Gaultier. Nothing too flamboyant, but it kind of has an edge to it.
What color's your hair?
My hair is black, jet black, like a raven.
How come you dyed it black?
Well, let's not go into that. It's always been dark.
Boy, that's like the last thing I thought that he wouldn't want to talk about.
Well, you know, my hair kind of changes color daily as I take it in and out of the box.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
It's like a kind of living Cindy doll approach.
Got it. Okay. You know, when I first saw you perform, I wasn't sure whether the drag was just a way to get attention, you know, and you actually like went home and put on khakis and a shirt and tie, or whether, you know, you really enjoy dressing in drag and always had.
Well, when I was a teenager, I started dressing up. When I discovered David Bowie, that was my kind of extravagant style began. In Culture Club, I did kind of look like that most of the time. These days, I'm more likely to go home and put on a pair of baggies, you know, because I like to have a distinction between what I do on stage. And there is more of a separation now than there used to be. I was kind of trapped in that image for years. I couldn't bear to let people see me looking normal. Now I don't give a damn.
What's changed for you that you don't care now?
I guess I'm more comfortable with my appearance, my physical appearance, without the armor, without the drag. So there's more of a balance, and it just makes dressing up more fun, you know, because it's not something you have to do as an obligation.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you into style before you were old enough to go to the clubs?
The first line in my book is, when I was a little boy, I wanted to be Shirley Bassey. So I've always been attracted to style and dramatic gestures. I grew up with a fascination for all things different. I used to watch those Busby Berkeley movies on the Saturday TV on Saturday, and I just always loved glamour and pizzazz.
And when did you start to try to become that?
I guess around the age of about 11 years old, when I started to really get into pop music, that was around the time of the glam scene.
Mm-hmm.
So there were people like David Bowie, Mark Bolan, all sorts of fantastic performers, and that's when I really started getting into it.
Now, when did you start to sing?
Well, I always used to sing along to pop records. I used to walk around the streets with a transistor radio to my ear, and I learned all the words to every pop song you could imagine. So I was always singing all my childhood and all through my teenage years. And people used to say, you know, you have a good voice, why don't you try and become a singer? But it just seemed so out of reach when I was a teenager. And when punk rock came along, it really opened the door for people like me, because prior to that, you really had to pay your dues and spend years on the road. And punk kind of kicked down the door and turned everything upside down.
So what was your singing like when, you know, during the punk era?
Well, my first band was called In Praise of Lemmings. So it kind of gives you an idea of what kind of... And we had this song, which was called Mask. And it was I was really influenced by Susie and the Banshees. I was a big Susie Banshee fan. So it was kind of very droney, kind of make a mask for me. All that kind of deep baritone type stuff and very suicidal. But I soon snapped out of that.
Boy George is my guest. He has a new autobiography called Take It Like a Man. He also has a new CD that's just been released called Cheapness and Beauty. Tell us the story of how Culture Club got started.
Well, I was in this band called Bow Wow Wow, and they threw me out. But I had the bug. I'd been on stage. I'd gotten a kind of taste of it. So I started to look for my own band. And that's really how it happened. I just rang around. And then once I got a couple of members of the band, we started to look for other people.
So one of the co-founders of the band, John Morris, who you know, was the drummer, you were lovers with him for a long time.
We were lovers pretty soon after we met. John was the kind of driving force behind the band, you know, getting things organized. He was a real sort of go-getter type person. So he was the kind of practical force within the band.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of fell in love within about 3 months of meeting each other. And that's really what made the whole thing so exciting. But as we got more and more successful, our relationship kind of fell apart, you know, the pressures of being successful and jealousy, immaturity. I mean, it really kind of wore us down.
In your book, you say that you actually wanted people to know that you were gay, but John didn't want you to reveal that.
Well, John didn't want people to know about us
mm-hmm.
and our relationship because, on the one hand, he felt that the media, if they knew, might try to interfere and write bad things about us. And I guess also there was a lot of fear on John's part because he wasn't very comfortable with his sexuality. But as far as I was concerned, you know, I was out of the closet at 16. My parents knew when I was 16 years old. So it was very frustrating for me to be kind of living in limbo, almost living a lie. I mean, obviously, the way I looked and the way that I behaved, I think made it quite clear to a lot of people what I was. But I was sitting on the fence and it was a very difficult thing for me to do.
What advice did your record company give you when you signed?
My record company never, ever gave me any advice about my sexuality. Nobody ever interfered. I think people don't want to talk about it. The general attitude in the business is they'd rather not know. You know, if we don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. I mean, I never had any of that. I mean, no one in my management or in my record company ever said, you know, don't say. They just didn't talk about it.
Let me play the record that was your first hit in the States. Was it, I'm going to play Do You Really Want to Hurt Me. Was that your first hit in England also?
It was our third single, but it was our first successful record.
Do you want to say anything about writing the song, how you feel about it now?
Well, I guess in those days, I was a bit of a victim. And this song is very kind of woe is me. You know, it was a song about John, all about the fact that, you know, he wasn't sort of giving 100% to the relationship and he wasn't being honest with himself. So I guess it has a certain poignancy.
Okay, this is Boy George, Culture Club, singing Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, the first hit in the States.
Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Precious kisses, words that burn me. Love has never asked you why. In my heart the fire's burning. Choose my color, find a star. Precious people always tell me that's a step, a step too far.
I thought it was interesting in your book, you say that at some point you realize that all the fans that surrounded your house and that really wanted to get close to you, it wasn't so much that they cared about you, they cared about being close to fame, being close to celebrity.
Well, I can only kind of relate it to my own experiences as a teenager. You know, I used to stand outside David Bowie's house and I used to go to radio stations and I used to touch him as he, you know, I used to try and touch him and scream as he came out of the building. I don't really know why I did that. When I think about it now, I think, how ridiculous. But I guess in some way I related to David Bowie. He was somebody a little weird. He was bisexual. I knew I was gay. So he was kind of like a god to me. He was a kind of release and escape. I don't know if that's true of my fans, but I think a lot of the girls that were kind of into Culture Club and into me, I think they really recognised a certain frailty and a certain vulnerability in me, and I think that was what was the attraction.
My guest is Boy George. He has a new autobiography called Take It Like a Man and a new CD called Cheapness and Beauty. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Boy George. You write in your book that you became trapped in your own image. You had had a lot of different styles before you really became famous. Was the image that you had when you became famous one that you were expected to keep?
Well, I don't think I was expected to keep it.
I mean, were you expected to keep, like, that hairdo and that outfit?
Well, it kind of worked. So it was, I mean, the look that I had in Culture Club was a kind of watered down look of all the looks I'd had since I was a teenager.
Describe it.
Well, it was the big Hasidic hat.
I never thought of it that way.
Well, it was actually a proper Jewish hat that I wore.
Really?
Which was a present from John. It was actually a Frummer's hat.
Huh.
And then I wore it with sort of dreadlock braids with ribbons.
Uh-huh.
And my clothes were kind of psychedelic and baggy. Not really women's clothes, kind of blurring the boundaries. I mean, kind of androgynous, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't wear breasts. I wasn't really trying to be a woman. I was really contradicting all those sort of rigid ideas of what is male and female.
What about the image of the rest of the band?
Oh, I did terrible things to them. I mean, I made them wear things that they looked absolutely ridiculous in. Once I made Roy have white dreadlocks, which was a pretty hideous look. And then there was a time in Japan when I made them all wear these kind of very tight sort of lycra shorts with clip-on suspenders. That wasn't a particular favourite look of theirs. I was very bossy. I mean, I used to... I guess because they were kind of quite straight-laced, so I used to try and spice them up a bit and make them look more interesting.
Mm-hmm. When you came to America and you had become a star here and you started doing television shows here, shows that you didn't know, it must have been an interesting experience. Like in your book, you write about being on Live with Regis Philbin, and what a disorienting experience that was. Would you tell us about that?
Well, when we arrived at the show, I couldn't believe that all the audience were wearing flared trousers and wide lapel jackets and big funky collared shirts, you know, and we looked like space aliens. It was like so bizarre because we seemed like to be from another planet.
You know, he's got a wildly popular show now.
Absolutely, yeah.
Are you on it?
I did it this morning.
Yeah. Now, you did Solid Gold. And I thought it was really interesting. You wouldn't let the Solid Gold dancers share the stage with you because why?
I thought they were tacky, to be honest with you.
Well, I have to agree with you.
I mean, I felt that the whole setup of Solid Gold was a bit 70s, and we were all about doing something modern, something revolutionary, and I just thought that they jarred with our image.
So were you really had the power to say, sorry, you can't use your own dancers on the show?
Well, I said you can use them, but just not behind us, thank you.
So,
I was a bit of a tyrant in those days. I mean, I used to pull weight a lot. You know, I used to really get, you know, very uppity about things, and I would refuse to do the show. I would just simply say, well, if they're on, we're not, you know. And, of course, I got away with it a lot of the time.
One year when you won a Grammy, you said, well, why don't you repeat what you said?
I said, thank you, America. You got style and taste, and you know a good drag queen when you see one.
Now, how did you decide to say that?
It just kind of flew out of my mouth. I mean, it wasn't like I sat down and planned to say it.
Oh, you hadn't?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, a lot of the things I say kind of just burst out, you know. And I remember after that, I was told that a lot of the people from CBS Records, who I was signed to at that time, had fallen off their chairs and were, like, weeping and, you know, kind of dying in shock on the floor. So I was quite pleased about that.
Did they say anything to you afterwards?
Well, I think that up until that point, and I say this in the book, up until that point, my sexuality had been kind of hovering in a huge question mark. And by saying I was a drag queen, I was kind of saying I was gay. So it really did change things for me after that. I mean, it kind of signaled a kind of almost like, you know, it was like almost like the end of Culture Club, because people had always wanted to see me as this kind of sexless, inoffensive, exotic doll. And suddenly I was sort of being sexual and being provocative, and it really freaked people out.
So did it change your audience's reaction to you?
Well, I did hear that there were kind of college debates about what I actually meant. You know, people did take it far more seriously than it was, you know, than was necessary. But I guess in those days, you know, it was quite a shocking thing. I mean, mm-hmm. Now you have drag queens on every kind of, you know, movie you can see, and they're on TV all the time. But at that time, I suppose people found that shocking, you know.
I guess as Boy George, he has a new autobiography called Take It Like a Man, and he also has a new CD called Cheapness and Beauty. You started using drugs after the band caught on. How did it change your personality when you got involved with heroin?
Well, I think drugs really help you to escape. And a drug like heroin is almost like a womb-like drug, you know. You just completely cut off from your feelings. You don't care about anybody or anything. And you almost have this kind of superior air about you that is hard to imagine unless you've done it.
You know, in your book, you say that on tours you got into, you know, destroying expensive hotel rooms.
No, never.
Oh, that's what I thought it said. No,
no, never did anything like that. You know, when I was a kid, I used to get very upset watching Laurel and Hardy bust up these houses. It used to really upset me. I would never, ever do anything like that. I mean, that's something, I guess, you know, coming from a quite poor family, you know, my mother really had to kind of scrape to get by. And she was very house proud, so I would never, ever bust up a hotel.
I'm really glad. I just think it's so spoiled to do that.
I hate it
when rock stars do that.
Oh, no, I've never done that. Oh, no, not me. Ozzy Osbourne, but not me.
How did you end up kicking heroin?
Well, unfortunately, I lost two very close friends of mine. And that was a real sharp shock. Because I realised if I carried on, I'd be next. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, I had the world's media on my back. I felt like almost like a rat in a corner. You know, I really didn't have any choice because everybody was saying, please give up, you know, pull yourself together. And as I say, you know, losing my friend Michael and my friend Mark was really what I needed. And I'm sad to say that, you know, because, you know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think of them, you know, and wish I could turn back the clock, wish I could have done something, you know.
You have a new autobiography and a new CD. The CD is called Cheapness and Beauty. And the first track on it is a David Bowie song, who you've said was such an important influence on you early on. Tell us why you chose to kick off the record with
actually,
it.
It's actually an Iggy Pop Bowie collaboration. It's actually an Iggy Pop song, but it was written by Iggy and David. And it's one of the many songs from my kind of teenage years that I love. Again, it's very hard to choose one Iggy Pop song to cover, but I think this one is quite obscure. And it reminds me of a time in my life when I had no responsibilities, when I was kind of having fun all the time.
And it's called Fun Time. And thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Boy George has a new autobiography called Take It Like a Man and a new CD called Cheapness and Beauty. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the co-creator of the TV show the whole world seems to be watching, Baywatch. It's known in some circles as Babe Watch. Also, we meet Danny Amos of Los Straitjackets, a guitar band that plays surf music for the 90s. We're listening to it now. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the last book by the late Stanley Elkin.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The most popular TV show in the world is about the adventures of Southern California lifeguards. More importantly, it's the adventures of hunks and trunks and babes in bathing suits who are filmed in slow motion as they run across the sand and dive into the ocean to rescue the latest drowning victim. And when they're not saving people, they're learning important life lessons about how to forge meaningful relationships and uphold the law.
On the next Baywatch.
Beer. Where'd you get that?
It's the last call for alcohol.
A couple DUIs, some drunken bar brawl.
For some unwelcome visitors.
So I took a couple sips. What, you've never done it?
Not while I'm working.
Will it be a sobering experience?
I won't let some sicko sex maniac cost me my career.
Or will they hit the drink?
You think you should be riding after drinking?
On the next Baywatch.
Baywatch is so popular it's now stripped in syndication, and there's a new spinoff called Baywatch Nights, in which two Baywatch stars, David Hasselhoff and Greg Allen Williams, open a detective agency. My guest Michael Burke is a co-creator of Baywatch and Baywatch Nights. I asked him how many countries Baywatch is seen in.
Baywatch is in approximately 144 countries, translated into 15 different languages, and we're told we have 1 billion viewers a week watching the show.
What are some of the more unusual places that you're watched in?
Well, I know that the show is dubbed into Mandarin, that we're in mainland China, and the first U.S. show sold to mainland China. We're down in the Amazon rainforests. We've seen film of people cranking up their generators and turning on Baywatch on black and white TVs. Actually, my understanding is we're also on in countries like Iran, that basically have women covering their faces all the time. But as far as Baywatch is concerned, I guess it's okay that they uncover their faces and other parts of their anatomy.
So what do you think lies behind the incredible popularity internationally of Baywatch?
Well, I think that it's a California lifestyle that people are interested in seeing. Sometimes it's accurate, sometimes it's a little bit fantastical. I think that it's the blue skies on a winter day and the warm sun. I think it's stories that people can relate to universally, the visuals of the show. And we have a very appealing cast that I think, led by David Hasselhoff, people have interest in.
When you mentioned the visuals and the appealing cast, if we put that together, can we also talk about their bodies, which I'm sure is part of the attraction?
I think it's part of the attraction. I think it's like a safety net in getting us an audience, because certain people will tune in for that. But there's been a lot of shows that have tried to do that, and they haven't stayed on for 6 years, because if you just have that, it grows thin very quickly. So I think that that brings people in, perhaps, but we tell very good stories, and by the end of the hour, I think people are very entertained and satisfied and willing to come back to see more of these people. They like these characters. They want to invite them into their homes. They're real people. I think once you get past the fact that they're attractive and sexy, you're also interested in their lives. Mitch Buchanan, played by David Hasselhoff, is a single father. We deal with the problems of being a single father and family and raising a child in today's world, and we deal with our women and our men pretty equally. They are both in positions of authority. They're both male and female heroic. They save people's lives. They are responsible people and basically good role models. They just happen to wear bathing suits as their uniform.
An episode I recently saw, I don't know, tell me if you think this is a typical episode.
Okay.
This is the subplot that stands out most in my mind. The head of Virgin Records comes to the West Coast.
Right. One of our worst episodes of all time.
Do you think so? Okay, well, let me finish.
Okay, go ahead.
The head of Virgin Records is I forget whether it's a boat race or some boat demonstration he's doing.
He's trying to set a world's record for water skiing being towed behind his own blimp.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Yeah. And if something gets messed up and he ends up nearly drowning, and a young woman whose secret desire is to be a rock star saves him, and in return he gives her a recording contract, and then everybody sings and dances on the beach as Little Richard plays piano in the final scene.
Congratulations, Mr. Branson. Once again, you're going to be in the Guinness Book of Records.
Well done.
Yeah, well done.
Congratulations, well, mate.
Thanks to you, lads. I'll be around to savor my moment of glory.
No worries, mate. All in a day's work.
Well, just the same, is there anything maybe I could do for any of you?
Well, actually, there is something you could do for me, that is. I'm a singer, and, well, I was hoping you'd listen to my song.
Well, since you helped save my life, that's the least I can do.
Yes!
Totally atypical episode, not our typical episode. That episode was developed because, you know, David Hasselhoff is very gregarious, very friendly, meets a lot of people and says, why don't you come and do Baywatch? You know, I mean, says it to Little Richard and says it to Richard Branson, who owns Virgin Airlines, and, you know, kind of a bunch of different people. And it was towards the end of the season. Usually we're very prepared at the beginning of a season. We do 22 episodes, and it's myself and a couple of other writers who are preparing scripts week after week that we have to be ready. A series television is really this giant monster that devours scripts every week and wants more and more. And towards the end of the season, usually we're scrambling for scripts. So David comes and says, okay, listen, I got Richard, Little Richard, and I've got all these people, and come up with a story that incorporates them all. And Branson wants to ski behind his blimp and this and that and the other. And so one of our writers kind of put together a show trying to incorporate all these elements, and it didn't evolve the way most of our shows evolve, from a solid story or specific character backgrounds. And it was really a hodgepodge show that was not one of our best efforts, I don't think. So, you know, that happens. Out of 135 episodes, there's three or four that aren't great and certainly aren't typical of the show.
Tell me about first casting David Hasselhoff in the leading role. When he was cast in the leading role, I mean, he was best known for his time on The Young and the Restless and also for his starring role in the TV series Knight Rider, in which he had a talking car whose voice was the voice of William Daniels, who played a temperamental surgeon later on St. Elsewhere. So did you have confidence that David Hasselhoff could become the kind of international star that he has?
Well, we didn't really even think of that at the time.
I guess you weren't thinking international yet.
No, it was a great blessing. What happened is we had gotten a pickup from NBC to do this movie, and we had written the character of Mitch Buchanan. We had written another character, Craig Pomeroy, who was a lawyer lifeguard. But anyway, we were looking for this lead actor, and David Hasselhoff's name was brought up by our casting director, and we brought him in for a meeting. He had been in Europe developing a singing career. And because after Knight Rider, he was having a problem getting cast. So he developed his own singing career, which, you know, turned out to be, he became a superstar in Germany and in some other countries in Europe. And at first, David didn't want to do it. He turned it down. And we brought him back for a second meeting and showed him this video that we had and told him our concept for the show, that it wasn't, as most people always thought, when they first heard it, you know, Beach Boys, you know, running around in their shorts, that it was really about heroes and saving lives and had substantial story potential.
And also had Beach Boys running around in their shorts.
Well, yeah, but that certainly wasn't what he was looking for as an actor. I mean, he was concerned already that he had a reputation for talking to a car, and now he's supposed to be running around in red shorts. You know, is this going to be okay for my career? But ultimately, he felt that on the strength of the character being a single father, being the lieutenant, that we had character stuff that we wanted to do for him, that he can, you know, sort of sink his teeth in and show his ability as an actor, not just a personality. He ultimately took the part, and after the show was canceled, he went off into other things. And as we started trying to put it together again, his strength as a personality and star in Europe was a major factor in getting the financing for doing the show again in syndication.
Now, what about casting the women, the actresses on Baywatch? Are there auditions like in swimsuits and stuff?
Not initially. Initially, they come in and perform scenes from the show. If we think that they're appropriate, what they then have to do is swim. For the original movie, we cast an actress for the lead part, and we asked her, can you swim? And she said, certainly, of course. So we cast her, and on the first day on the set, we found out not only couldn't she swim, but she was afraid of the water. And my God, now what are we going to do? So we actually had to recast her immediately after the first day of shooting. And from then on, every actress that's cast first has to go through a swim where they're viewed in the water. And they actually, all our actors who become lifeguards have to go through lifeguard training. You know, it's very important to us. We work very closely with the actual lifeguards who've actually given us their headquarters to build part of our set in. And everything we do has to be very accurate. The CPR is very accurate. As a matter of fact, we get letters every so often. We've just received another one, which is about our 15th one of having saved lives around the world by people who have rescued other people from drowning and given them CPR. And when asked, how did you know what to do? They said, we learned it on Baywatch. So we were just given the Red Cross Spirit Award and David Hasselhoff was asked to be a national spokesman for the Red Cross because we have literally, you know, here's this kind of show Baywatch that people call Babe Watch, has literally saved 15 lives around the world for people who have learned proper CPR technique from watching the show.
Something I find interesting, like you said, you know, a lot of people called Baywatch Babe Watch or Bun Watch or Butt Watch. And, you know, TV Guide had a big article under the category of guilty pleasures about Baywatch. It's a show that a lot of people watch and a lot of people think is kind of, you know, fantastic and silly at the same time, right? You seem to have no irony about it. I mean, so many people who watch Baywatch watch it with a sense of irony, and you seem to be really straight about it, wanting to stress the lives it saved. And
well, we have to look at it realistically as far as real lifeguards, but I guarantee you we're aware of the irony. As a creative person, I want to be able to fulfill myself creatively. So we do a variety of episodes. We did an episode where they fantasize they're on Gilligan's Island. We've done episodes that Jeff Altman plays a Hollywood producer who's coming to the beach trying to figure out his next television series and sees our lifeguards running around in bathing suits and says, this is a great idea, a show about, you know, lifeguards in bathing suits, my God. And we did a parody of ourselves creating the show. We've also done very realistic shows. We've done suspense shows. You know, we never have limited ourselves to the kinds of shows we can do. What we've always loved is when Jay Leno started making fun of the show, Mad Magazine did a takeoff on the show, Saturday Night Live did a takeoff on the show, and that was great for us because we realized that we started to become part of the public consciousness and started part of the culture. My uncle created Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch. I mean,
Sherwood Schwartz.
Sherwood. Douglas Schwartz, my partner, and Douglas and I, my partner, are first cousins. Our mothers are sisters. So we grew up making movies together. We did our first movie that we sold to CBS when we were 13 years old. And so we've been doing this since we were kids. And when we did Baywatch, Sherwood said to us, Baywatch is your Gilligan's Island. Don't blow it. And the reality is it's ironic that just as Gilligan has become part of the culture, Baywatch has become part of the world culture. And we're aware that it's got its diverse appeal to people, and that it's the humor, it's the kitsch, but at the same time, you get people tuning in for that, and subtly, you know, I just wrote and directed an episode about AIDS that we dealt with on Baywatch. We were just given an award for dealing with handicapped people because we did a show with 130 Down syndrome kids that we did a Special Olympics show on the beach. You know, we do deal with it with issues and with heartwarming stories and certain amount of reality, and then the next week we'll do this kind of silly show about in 130 episodes we've done one bikini contest, but you know we'll do that too.
Michael Burke is co-creator of Baywatch and the new spin-off Baywatch Nights. Coming up, new surf music. This is Fresh Air. There's a new guitar band that plays surf music with a lot of fire and without camp. At least the music isn't campy. I'm not so sure about the band's name. They're called Los Straitjackets, and they're based in landlocked Nashville. The two founders of the band are guitarist Eddie Angel and my guest Danny Amos. This is Amos's third surf band. We'll meet him after we hear the opening track of Los Straitjackets' new CD. Danny Amos, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Tell me why you put together a surf band.
Well, it's not necessarily a surf band. It's an instrumental band. We like to think we have a lot of different influences and sounds. I couldn't tell you why instrumentals. It's fun to create melody lines, have the freedom to create a melody line without having lyrics to anchor them to.
Now, were guitar bands, you know, the guitar band sound a part of your rock and roll past, or was it music that you discovered while following your tastes into the past that preceded you?
Well, it was just something I grew up listening to. The Fender guitar sound, the sound the Ventures had, just has always stuck in my mind as being the definitive guitar sound for me.
Now, the kind of twangy sound that you get on this album. Do you require a certain kind of guitar or a certain kind of amp to get exactly the sound that you want?
I pretty much have to use an old tube amp. Well, not necessarily an old tube amp, but it has to be tubes to get that warmth in the sound. I prefer a Fender guitar. The Jazzmaster is what I play. Eddie likes to play a Stratocaster. And that's just more as far as preference, as far as the way the guitar feels and all that. But I think probably the most important thing is we don't use any effects. We like to, both Eddie and I, just plug straight into the amp, and we use the reverb that's in the amp itself, and pretty much just stick with that. I think if you overload things with too many electronic devices, you kind of lose some of the definition of the guitar.
Why did you name the band Los Straitjackets?
Well, for years I've been going down to Mexico and adding to my collection of early Mexican rock and roll records. And there were a lot of great bands down there with names like Los Teen Tops and Los Rockin' Devils and Los Beatniks. And I always thought the Spanish article followed by an English noun had a really great sound to it. And when we put this band together, we named the band after a song of ours called Straitjacket, and thought we'd throw the Los in on the head of it just to kind of pay homage to some of my favorite old bands.
So I believe you brought a Mexican rock and roll band to play for us.
I've got Los Teen Tops doing Confidente de Secundaria, which you may recognize as High School Confidential by Jerry Lee Lewis.
Óyeme, preciosa, hazme caso que soy yo quien te llama. Ya los muchachos y las chicas se preparan para ir a bailar. Pues la fiesta ya empezó y la orquesta ya llegó. Fuera los zapatos, fuera las corbatas, vamos a bailar el rock. Que si tu confidente soy, que yo en secundaria voy. Si tu confidente soy, que yo en secundaria voy. Soy tu confidente, soy de secundaria.
So, Danny Amos, what does that record do for you?
There is something about the Spanish language doing rock and roll that I really think sounds wonderful. I've heard rock and roll in other languages, but nothing seems to do it like Spanish.
Let me get you to introduce one final track for us. How about University Boulevard?
Okay, this is a song of Eddie Angel's, named after University Boulevard in Silver Springs, Maryland, I believe.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
All right, thank you.
Danny Amos is a guitarist with Los Straitjackets. The band's new CD is on Upstart Records, and this is University Boulevard. This is Fresh Air. Throughout his long career, writer Stanley Elkin won wide acclaim for his 16 books, including the National Book Critics Circle Award for his novel, George Mills. Our own book critic, Maureen Corrigan, says Elkin's final novel, Mrs. Ted Bliss, will no doubt garner its share of raves, but it probably won't win any awards from the Miami Chamber of Commerce.
I've always meant to read Stanley Elkin, along with 1,000 or so other authors who are on my must-read list. People who've recommended him always praised his Yiddish-inflected humor, his comic touch with cosmic truths. But often, death does what all the word-of-mouth recommendations and publicity promos can't. It's perverse, but when I heard that Elkin had died this past June, I felt more compelled to read his posthumous novel, Mrs. Ted Bliss. Based on this one Elkin experience, I'd say that if, like Jim Morrison, Emily Dickinson, and James Dean, Stanley Elkin's popularity skyrockets after his death, he's a writer who deserves it. Elkin's heroine, Mrs. Ted Bliss, is a widow in her 70s who finds herself caught in the midst of a culture war being waged within her Miami condo complex. Most of the condos are owned by retired Northern Jews like herself. But recently, wealthy Colombians and Chileans have been moving in. The old-timers try to be welcoming. They even hold rec room socials like Hands Across the Panama Canal Night. Mingling between the two groups, however, is minimal, until a Venezuelan named Señor Chitral makes Mrs. Bliss an offer on Ted's old Buick LeSabre. Mrs. Bliss sells and shortly thereafter finds herself the key witness in a cocaine trial. It turns out that the debonair Señor Chitral thought the Buick would make an ideal dope locker. Other outlandish incidents follow. There's a platonic relationship between Mrs. Bliss and Ted's old butcher store partner. There's the requisite Passover family blowout scene and even a King Lear-like ending involving Hurricane Andrew. But no matter what extraordinary incidents befall Mrs. Bliss, Elkin makes his readers understand that growing old itself is more bizarre, more absurd, more dumbfounding than practically anything else that can happen. You think getting involved in cocaine trafficking is so strange, Mrs. Bliss might say? Try waking up one day and realizing that most of your loved ones are dead and that you're incontinent. That's when life really starts getting psychedelic. Actually, I shouldn't put words into Mrs. Bliss's mouth, because Elkin has given her such a marvelous voice, any imagined dialogue is just chopped liver. It sounds lame to praise Elkin simply for being able to write realistic speech. That is until you realize how much of other fictional dialogue sounds canned or self-consciously flashy. Elkin here masters those little exchanges that speak volumes. For instance, when Mrs. Bliss goes to a therapist for a consultation, he asks her what her interests are. "Cooking," Mrs. Bliss replies. "Mexican, continental, Japanese? What sort of cooking?" "Supper, coffee, dessert, cooking." "What else?" asks the therapist. "Breakfast, lunch, not now, not so much." To me, those lines evoke not only Mrs. Bliss's personal history, but a whole generational worldview. All throughout this novel, I kept thinking of another line by another great old dame, Betty Davis. "Old age ain't for sissies," Betty once said. Sure seems that way, although if, like Mrs. Bliss, you manage to hold on to your sense of the ridiculous, it can afford some last laughs. Meanwhile, before more time goes by, I'm going to stock up on Elkin and call my mother.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Stanley Elkin's novel, Mrs. Bliss. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Robert Palmer, chief consultant to the PBS series on the history of rock and roll. We'll close today's show with one of Palmer's favorite singers, Sam Cooke.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.